This one-hour Brodmann tape is concerned entirely with the subject of life eternal, the meaning of life eternal. It will be our purpose in this study to dig back into history and find out some of the ideas that men have had from the very dawn of history about this very exciting question of the possibility of life after death. In addition to studying the Egyptian, the Hindu, the ancient Greek, and some other viewpoints about life after death, we will concentrate naturally on a biblical study, showing how through the Old Testament the concept developed, and how finally in the New Testament the climax of the biblical teaching is reached. Naturally, in the New Testament study, the primary focal point is the resurrection of Jesus Christ and the implications of that historic event for man's hope and assurance of life after death. In addition, in the closing part of the tape, we will want to give some practical applications of this teaching for our daily lives. There's an idea abroad that any teaching about life after death is some kind of pie in the sky by and by. In fact, you've heard many people ridicule that sort of teaching and preaching. But a remarkable thing is happening in our day. In this highly technological, scientific day, there is a sudden burst of interest in the meaning of life eternal. Now, it's always been deep down in human nature, and to try to suppress it is to belie something that is native to our very human being in itself. Let us go back first to some of the most ancient civilizations of man, and let us find out how the concepts of life hereafter, life after death, developed. One of the oldest historic civilizations is the one that grew up in the Valley of the Nile, the Egyptian civilization. Everyone remembers the stories of the great pyramids, of the pharaohs who were embalmed and turned into mummies in order that their bodies might be preserved for an afterlife. Let us look into that for a moment and see what it implies about their beliefs concerning the life after death. To begin with, the Egyptians were deeply influenced already by the culture to the east of them, the so-called Sumerian or Old Babylonian culture. Now, we're not going to go into all of the technical details of this history. We're going to try to make it practical and applicable to life today. But before we can understand the Bible and understand the contemporary relevance of this teaching, we must find out what these ancient men believed. When the pharaohs were buried in their pyramids, or sometimes down in the Valley of the Kings in the upper valley of the Nile, they would nearly always bury with them a boat. The purpose of the boat was, of course, to carry the pharaoh across that ancient river into the land of the future. Sometimes they would bury with them their servants in order that they might have servants to wait on them in the afterlife. And almost always they buried with them food, various equipment, weapons, armament, utensils, household utensils, and as well their treasures, gold and silver and precious stones. The idea being that they might not be bereft of their treasures, but be very affluent in the afterlife as they had been in this life. Now, it's simple to see what that means in terms of belief. They believed that somehow the spirit or soul was separated from the body for a time by death, and that sometime in the future, maybe thousands of years in the future, the soul would come back looking for the body. That's why they took such great care to embalm the bodies. A mummy was nothing in the world but a carefully embalmed and dehydrated body. Do you know how they did it? The best archaeological scholars we have today believe that first they removed the internal organs of the body, and they were carefully preserved in a separate sealed jar in a solution not unlike our modern formaldehyde. The idea was that the internal organs were to be preserved as nearly intact as possible because these vital organs would have to function again, they believed, in the afterlife. Now, for the rest of the body, the skin, the skeleton structure, they did another thing. They apparently rubbed the body with a saline solution, a heavy salt solution, and then exposed it to the sunlight and let it dry, and in the process, the remaining part of the body was completely dehydrated. It became as dry as a piece of stick. There's also an indication that they rubbed some kind of preservative oil on the skin to retard its drying and cracking. That's why you can walk into the mummy room in Cairo Museum today and see the mummy of Ramesses II, 1292 B.C., and here a body dead more than 3,000 years is in a remarkable state of preservation. You can touch the skin, and it feels like a well-tanned baseball glove, just a nice piece of leather. Now, this idea of preserving the body was in order that the spirit might recognize its former dwelling place, its former habitation, when it came back centuries later in the afterlife, searching out its body. These people thought that unless they made the body look as natural as possible, that the soul might not recognize its former habitation and might wind up in the wrong place. That's the basic idea back of it. Now, you're aware that this same idea of preparing people for the journey across the river to that promised land and of providing them with food and servants and maybe weapons for battle has been carried on in many other cultures. Even our American Indians had almost the same idea. Many of the Oriental peoples had a similar idea. You look into the graves far into the Ural Mountain regions of Russia or Siberia, and you will find the same thing. Hunting dogs are buried with their masters. Bows and arrows, weapons are buried with them in order that they might be able to fend for themselves in the happy hunting ground of the future. Right on until this day, Indians down in Mexico and Central America are often buried with their favorite hunting dogs, and in a few of the more primitive tribes, they will sometimes bury their wives or their servants with them in order to be sure that they have company in their journey to the afterlife. Now, that concept has one thing that we underline here for our purpose. It's a belief in personal survival. Note that. Extremely important because it becomes a key idea in biblical thought. All of these historical concepts stemming from the Egyptian held to an idea of a personal survival of the individual, his body to be reconstituted in some way or other. And another important fact is that they viewed the afterlife as some kind of a continuation of this life. In other words, your life here would affect your life there. If you were a great hunter here, you might become an even greater hunter there. If you were a great king or pharaoh here, then you ought to be a great ruler or a monarch over there. And this idea of a correlation or even a continuity between this life and the life hereafter is another important concept growing out of the ancient Egyptian teaching. Now let's look at a very different kind, extremely popular in the Far East, and one that is affecting our beliefs and practices in America today. Let us call it the Hindu or Far Eastern religious view of life after death. This is very typical of Buddhism, of Hinduism, Jainism, Taoism, the other religions of the Far East, primarily of China, India, and to a lesser extent of Japan. What is their belief? It is the view that reality is always in the form of spirit or mind. That is, it's invisible. And they hold that there is a kind of non-reality to the physical world. In fact, if you take an ancient Hindu philosopher and confront him directly with the question, "What is the real?" he will always answer, "The invisible, the spiritual." If you tell him, "But you have a body," he would say, "I only appear to have a body." If you say, "Look, the body dies," he will say, "It only appears to die." Reality is on the side of the spirit. Now, so far, so good. Even some Christian teachings tend to emphasize spirit over matter. But remember that the biblical teaching is that God, who is spirit, created the material world, that he made man a physical being out of the dust of the earth and made him in his own image. And the clinching argument for the Christian is that God became flesh and blood in Jesus Christ of Nazareth and gave his stamp of approval to the reality of this physical order. But now the Hindus, the Buddhists, just cannot accept that way of thinking. They view the soul as the real, the body as the unreal or the imaginary, they tend to reject any reality to human history, and they make all reality belong to the realm of invisible spirit. Now look what this does for their concept of life hereafter. They believe, for example, that the life is in the soul or the spirit. When the body dies, that makes no difference because the spirit goes right on into some other body. Now the Hindus in particular believe, in their various groups in India, that if one has lived a good, upright Hindu life, he will come back in another incarnation at a higher level of society. You know, they have various castes, a basic four-caste system, with the Brahmin caste being the highest one. And by coming back into a higher level, they believe that they move up a kind of ladder or stairway to the ultimate apex or climax of life, which is to be eventually relieved from the pain of reincarnation, so that one may be absorbed into the world of pure Brahma, or pure nirvana. Now their word nirvana, N-I-R-V-A-N-A, nirvana, means something like the invisible world soul. It's virtually equivalent to God, or God as spiritual being in their thought. And final redemption in Hindu religion is for a person to escape the physical body and to go into the world of pure spirit and to be absorbed like a drop of water is absorbed back into the great ocean. So the individual soul is utterly absorbed back into the great oversoul, or nirvana, and it loses its individual identity. Now, do you see the striking difference between these two ancient historical views of life hereafter, and for that matter, of life here? The Egyptian one is more historical. This is why they built great block or rock mausoleums, great pyramids, in order to give an historical monument. This is why they embalmed the body. They wanted a physical body to be preserved. But what do the Hindus do? They burn the body. They have a funeral pyre. And on this, they just put the body, build a great fire, burn it all up, send it back to the element of gas, smoke, ashes, a few remaining ashes, and they even like to scatter those on the Ganges or blow them into the wind and let them be distributed back over the earth and through the air. The difference is very striking. It means that one, the Egyptian, will look for a renewed body and for personal, individual immortality. On the other hand, it means that the Hindu or the Buddhist will look for utter loss of individual personality, absorption back into the great oversoul, and complete loss of identity. It's the eternal sleep of oblivion. Now, this has a bearing on many things. It has a bearing upon the way one treats the body today. You will find that the ancient Egyptians were very concerned about medicine. They wanted to heal the body. They wanted to have medical benefits that would cure various diseases. But in the Hindu religion, they care very little about the body. They've never developed much medicine in the Far East. They're now becoming interested in it because of the impact of Western civilization, but they cared very little about the body. They didn't worry about disease. They even tended to deny disease. The form of religion known as Christian Science in this country is derived directly from Hindu thought. Mary Baker Eddy lived for several years in the home of, or had living in her home, a Hindu fakir, or mystic, who taught her all these ideas, and written into her book on science and health is this Hindu mysticism that I've just been describing. Now let's go quickly on to the Greek and get one other historical viewpoint before we turn to the biblical teachings and then make some practical applications of that for our daily living. The Greek ideas grew naturally out of the historical viewpoints that preceded them. And when I mention the Greeks, I'm referring primarily to the great philosophers, Plato and Aristotle, and before them, the non-writing philosopher, Socrates, who is remembered primarily through his pupil and interpreter, Plato. We're thinking of a date about 4 1/2 centuries before the time of Christ. If you think about the Egyptians, of course, you're going back 3,000 years B.C. When you think about the Hindu and Eastern, You're going back about the same length of time, 3,000 years before Christ, and are talking about millennia of time. The Greeks, however, are much more recent, though they are somewhat more than 2,000 years ago. They're only half as old in terms of human history as these other philosophies we've been talking about. And because the Greeks were great scholars, great librarians, they preserved the writings of the Sanskrit language, which brought the Hindu religion into their libraries. They also had deciphered the hieroglyphics of the Egyptians and were able to read about the great pharaohs of the past and about Amenhotep and Akhenaten and some of these writers of the Egyptian antiquity. And consequently, the Greeks represent what we could call a syncretistic viewpoint. That is, a balanced summary of many viewpoints which went before. They tended to draw from several sources and to build a unified concept that embraced elements from two or three different historical sources. Now let's see how Plato, for example, did this in his writings like the Symposium or in his great works, the Phaedrus, the Phaedo, or the Republic. In his Allegory of the Cave, he gives us some of his concepts of life after death. What does Plato teach us? Let's put it in very concise summary fashion. Plato borrowed from the Egyptians his first idea, his emphasis upon the individual. He agreed with the ancient Egyptians that every individual soul or every individual human being is unique. And he tended to think that it was important for the individual to preserve his identity. Growing up in childhood, the Greeks put great stress on know thyself, be true to yourself. Don't try to copy everybody else, but be what you are. Have the courage to be different. A lot of our youth of today have bought this, whether they know it or not, and I personally think it's a very important and a great positive emphasis. We ought not to be simply reflections of everything around us. We ought to have the courage to be different, and we ought to have the courage to challenge some old traditions and see whether they stand up, in fact, under the pressure of life and of our personal experience. But now, not only did Plato draw from the Egyptians, he drew even more, I believe, from the Hindu philosophers, because he bought almost completely the idea of an immortal soul that existed eternally, and Plato even speculated that it might go through a cycle of reincarnations in various bodies, animal or human, up to a number of 10,000 times, he suggests in one of his plays, that it is possible for the human soul to be reincarnated that many times, if you can imagine. Now, what does this do? Let's just take Plato's idea of the way in which life exists now and the way in which it will exist hereafter. He says there is a world of pure archetypal reality. By archetype, he means a pattern or model from which everything else in the world today is but a carbon copy. That is, all trees, all mountains, all animals, all persons, every kind of reality you know, has a sort of prototype or pattern in this world of pure form. Sometimes he called it the realm of idea. Other times he called it the realm of archetypal form. I think we would understand it better to use in modern English the pattern room, where you have patterns from which everything else in the world is cut. Everything else is copied from these patterns. Or if you want to use the computer analogy, there was a certain original computer that was programmed, and everything that happens is but a working out of what is written into that eternal computer back there in the original archetypal world. This means, for example, that there are boy souls and girl souls floating around up there in that realm, and somehow the Creator, at a particular time, draws out one of those souls and drops it into the body. Incidentally, Socrates and Plato both speculated on when exactly the soul came into the human body. and they decided it probably occurred at the moment of quickening in the womb, when the fetus, prenatally, began to make its first movement in the body of the mother. They supposed that was a sign that the immortal soul had been dropped into the body. Well, they're using imagination here, but it was at least a sign that they could latch onto as meaning that some kind of new life or self-existence had come into the little tiny fetus developing in the mother's womb. Eventually, when the child is born, the baby is born, they believed that it had a separate existence when it was cut loose from the mother and began to breathe on its own, but they believed this was only temporary. All human life is transient, they argued. And, of course, in one way, they're right. Everybody knows the body is not permanent. It's always going on in the process of decay. Metabolism in our bodies simply tells us that we are taking in new energy or new sustenance. By the process of assimilation, we build up certain cells. The waste matter is carried off at the same time, and the process of metabolism goes on, and the body is both living and dying. It's in constant flux, and one of these days it will be completely dead and will go back to the dust of the earth, to the chemical composition out of which it was made. Now look what this does for the concept of life hereafter. It means first that life here is the temporary existence of a soul that is eternal in a body that is temporal. The body dies, the soul is liberated. It goes back into the world of pure soul, not to be absorbed like the Hindus say, but to exist individually and separately in that archive. Sometimes you get the impression that Plato visualized a great pigeonhole desk with a lot of compartments. And here was a compartment where Bill's soul went, and Jim's soul, and then Alice's soul went over here. And each one is filed away, somewhat like in a great universal filing cabinet. It means that salvation, viewed in Greek thought, is escape from the body. This is why they love to stress mystic contemplation, in which one who was very devout would try to contemplate upon his God or some meditation until he was utterly unconscious of his body and would become more or less joined to his God by a mystic contemplation. Now, this is like the Hindus. They borrowed this right out of Hinduism. Sometimes they even taught something like the levitation of the body. You know, the Hindu fakirs believe that they can become so unconscious of the body that they can lie on a bed of nails and feel no pain, or walk on hot burning coals barefooted and feel no pain, or look into the sun with their naked eye until they go completely blind and feel no pain. All this is an emphasis upon the denigration of the body, or the denial of the body, the rejection of the physical, to emphasize the spiritual. Now let's turn to the Old Testament concept and take just a few moments to develop this through drawing from these backgrounds. The Old Testament teaching is quite unique. The oldest idea that we find in the Bible concerning life after one's death is what I would call survival in one's descendants. Now, you can read this in the book of Genesis for yourself. It's all through. Man lives on in his offspring. Blessed is the man whose quiver is full of arrows, which being translated means, blessed is the man who has a house full of kids, because this way he will live on in his children and his grandchildren. Then you know that among the patriarchs, it became very important that they be buried with their fathers. That's why the cave of Machpelah was purchased by Abraham, because in that cave he could be joined with his fathers, and Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are all buried there, you know, and the wives of the patriarchs are all buried in that famous cave of Machpelah near Hebron. And the idea was that they could be near the departed bodies of their relatives. From this came another idea, Sheol, S-H-E-O-L. The word means a great hollow place in the ground. Sometimes it referred to the grave, but more often it meant a shadowy realm where the spirits or the shades of the departed move around in a kind of a misty darkness. It wasn't a very pleasant concept. For example, you can read in the book of Job all through. You can turn to Job 7, 9, and 10, and he really doesn't want to go to that dark and shadowy place, but he knows it's coming. Why, we wander around down there, he says, in that dark and shadowy land, and it's a dread place, and he looks upon it with great misgivings. As the cloud is consumed and vanished away, so he that goeth down to Sheol shall come up no more. He shall return no more to his house, neither shall his place know him any more. Now something else happens. Right in this book of Job, in the midst of his suffering, Job becomes convinced that there is no justice in this world unless there is a life beyond in which one can be vindicated, in which the righteous sufferer can be vindicated. Note this. I call it the turning point of the Old Testament. And it happens right in the book of Job. Job starts thinking about the tree. He says you can cut a tree down, and even a tree has more hope than a man, because you can cut a tree back to the ground, but water it, care for it, and it may sprout forth again. And when that happens, you have life out of the roots. Can it be, he says, that God will make a tree more important than a man? And so he begins to ask the question, if a man die, shall he live again? And in Job 19:25, we hear the ringing answer of faith. For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God. Great, confident promise there in the book of Job. Now, there's one other passage very important in the Old Testament. It's in a late book of the Old Testament, the book of Daniel. In the last chapter of the book, Daniel 12, we have two verses that explicitly describe resurrection. Daniel 12, 2 and 3. And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever. Now you know that that promise is explicit. Resurrection unto life or unto judgment. Resurrection unto a blessed state of righteousness or resurrection unto condemnation and judgment. Now that's the high point of the Old Testament teaching. And as we conclude now our study of the Old Testament teaching, let us simply say that beginning on a background like the Egyptians and the Hindus and the others, a man of faith and men of faith like Job came to believe that their Redeemer was living and that they one day would face him face to face.